So it's my distinct pleasure to welcome Professor Anthony Bateman. He's a consultant to the Anna Freud Centre and a visiting professor at the University College in London, and he's an honorary affiliate professor in psychotherapy in the University of Copenhagen. He and Peter Carnegie developed mentalization-based treatment for borderline personality disorder and studied its effectiveness in research trials. Adapted versions are now being used in multi-center trials for antisocial personality disorder, eating disorders, and drug addiction. He was an expert member of National Institute for Clinical Excellence, Development Group for Treatment Guidelines for Borderline Personality Disorder in the UK, and was chair of the National Guideline Development Group for Eating Disorders. His National Health Service clinical services are recognised by the Department of Health as a national demonstration site for the treatment of personality disorder. He was also president of the European Society for the Study of Personality Disorders from 2012 to 2015. He received a Senior Scientist Award from British and Irish Group for the Study of Personality Disorder in 2012, and in 2015 the Annual Award for Achievement in the Field of Severe Personality Disorders in the USA. He has authored 14 books, including Psychotherapy for Borderline Personality Disorder, Mentalization-Based Treatment, and Mentalization-Based Treatment for Personality Disorder, A Practical Guide with Peter Fonagy. He's also authored numerous book chapters and over 150 peer-reviewed research articles. Welcome, Anthony. It's wonderful to have you here.
Okay, well, thank you, Emily, and thank you to the NEA BPD for asking me to present this talk. I am going to talk really as a clinician mostly in this talk, rather than to go into detail about the sort of academic thinking behind mentalizing and mentalization-based treatment and borderline personality disorder. So the first thing I'd like to focus on is actually what, as clinicians, do we have to, how do we think about mentalizing if it's going to be useful to us as a clinician? And certainly, how is it going to be useful in the treatment of borderline personality disorder? So if we go to the first slide, I put what is mentalizing? In a way, this is a great question because it's not necessarily so clear. And I think one of the best ways to think about mentalizing is that it's manifestly a mental function, and it's how we actually integrate all the information we put together in our minds to actually make a coherent sense of ourselves and others in the world, really. So it's actually an imaginative mental activity about ourselves and others. And it's very important that we consider itself and others. It's not just a self experience, it's actually experiencing how others mental processes are functioning at any given time. And what we do is we piece that all together in various ways, and the piecing together of it is this higher order mental function, which we've called mentalizing. And of course, other people actually try to grasp the same processes, really, through using other terms like metacognition and so on. And we can argue and have fun with the differences between all these things, but they're all really trying to get hold of the same process, which is actually a mental activity about ourselves and others, of actually how we perceive and interpret behaviors. And we do so by actually thinking about them really in terms of mental states. You know, what lies behind, what makes someone do this, what makes them say this, what makes me do this, what makes me say this, or having my experience now. And this is what we call mentalizing. So we're trying to draw this out in a sort of cartoon in the second slide, where you'll see these slightly bald-headed poor learner, which is the patient, or a adolescent, say, or an education sort of pupil or something like that. And really, that person, if they want to talk about something about themselves rather than just simply about a topic of knowledge or something, actually comes with their own self-narrative. They come with a story of some sort about how they see themselves, how they experience themselves, and how they experience the world. Now, those of you who are really interested in borderline personality disorder will appreciate that, well, How well do people with borderline personality disorder do this sort of process? And they very often find it's incredibly difficult to work out what they really think or what they really feel or what they can rely on and things like that, both about themselves, but especially also about others. So they can also begin thinking about themselves as different from others or not being the same as others, or they have rather negative self-appraisal and so on. But basically, they come along with this sort of self-experience that they try to express to us as clinicians. Now, what we try to do, of course, is to actually understand their imagined self-narrative, this sort of mentalized self that they're presenting to us. And we try to form our own sort of representation in our own minds, that is, us, the clinicians, of them and their mind states. And we want to show them all the time that we've actually captured that in some way. So really, we're always trying to actually in some way, however we do it, verbally or through exercises or through other ways, to show them that actually we are representing them. We're seeing them as they see themselves, and we're not judging that. We're not sort of making anything more or less of it. We're simply trying to get it that it's an accurate match to their experience. And that is this sort of mentalizing interactive process that goes on. And mentalizing will always generate mentalizing. So as long as the clinician keeps mentalizing to some extent, then their patient or their client or their pupil or so on will also be able to create their mentalizing. In other words, they will feel felt, they will experience a sense of being seen, of being understood, and so on. And that process itself, we think, opens up a sense of what Peter Fonagy has really called a sort of communication channel. It allows them to think, well, there might be something here for me. This is about me, and actually they're seeing something about me that I can use and that's useful. So really matching these mental states, i.e. my patient needs to leave the room or be in the room and then leave the room thinking, yeah, that person I just seen actually seems to be able to represent me in a way that I find meaningful. So I can leave the room and have in my mind a representation of someone who can actually represent me reasonably accurately. And then I need to carry that with me for a time, if I can, so that it gives me some sense of actual hope and a sense of beginning to understand myself and the world. So that's a sort of mentalizing process. And in MBT, of course, you're trying to generate that process between you and the patient or client all the time. So that's a sort of general sort of way of thinking about mentalizing. So if you look at the basics of this process, it's been heavily researched, really, particularly developmentally. And mentalizing has its roots, really, in the attachment processes during development. And we know that they're loosely coupled. They sort of go hand in hand. They have some independence, as it were, but they rely on each other. And as we'll see shortly, in effect, to have good mentalizing during development and have robust, stronger mentalizing or effective mentalizing, a secure attachment process is necessary. But we also know that actually it's in the attachment processes that make it hard for people to actually maintain mentalizing. So they're inversely related in a sense. The more your attachment processes are triggered or stimulated, the more problematic it is to actually keep mentalizing effectively. Now, we know this, and those of you who've been in love, which I hope is everybody who listens to this, actually, when you're in love, you're not terribly good, really, about appraising yourself and your partner who you're in love with sort of necessarily accurately. You know, we have twinkles in our eyes, and we see twinkles in other people's eyes. It's only a bit later we realize that actually we need to reappraise that to some degree and things like that. So we're not good at mentalizing in intimacy. They tend to inhibit. They actually affect each other. Now, that's really important because we made a story, which was a story initially, but there has been increasing evidence for it, that in borderline personality disorder, there are attachment process problems. And that they're really tasked with trying to manage what are really overactive attachment processes in their general lives. And so as their attachment processes are sensitive and overactive, so their mentalizing is much more problematic to them. So borderline personality disorder becomes a large proportion of it is a relational disorder. So it's the interpersonal domain, relationship domain, that is distinctly important as one of the domains of problem for people with borderline personality disorder. So they have a sort of hyperactive, hypersensitive attachment system as a result of partly biology, partly constitution, of course, and then partly the sort of attachment processes that may be actually interfered with in all sorts of ways. This is not just a parental problem or something like that. The attachment processes can be interfered with in many, many different ways. Now, the interesting thing about mentalizing, once you start thinking about it in terms of personality and personality functioning, is that you can begin to think about the different personality types, if you like, or the different personality functioning in the mentalizing dimension. Okay, so we've also thought about it for antisocial personality disorder. So if you think about people with antisocial personality disorder, they show much less volatility or emotional volatility and sensitivity than people with borderline personality disorder. And indeed, we've actually found that they have a more deactivation of the attachment system. They try to disinvest in relationships. They want to control them more or have a hierarchy in a relationship where somebody's perhaps dependent on them or something of that nature. So they actually function differently both in their attachment and actually in their mentalizing processes when you look at them carefully. So you can begin to think about personality function in general in relation to mentalizing itself. So if we look at that in the next slide on the imbalance of mentalizing generating lots of problems, Patrick Leuten and others considered mentalizing as having different components, really. And they set these components out as sort of balancing systems. And these are balancing systems of mental function. So really when one is active, we balance it with another one. And they tend to work together in pairs in that sense. So this is not to be read as when you're doing a lot of one, you're doing less of the other on those lines. So, for example, if we take the cognitive affective line there, that's a dimension set out in this way. But actually, what it really means is, as part of mentalizing, we tend to have and activate our cognitive processing systems to understand things, but we also at the same time use our affective processing systems to inform that sort of appraisal and so on. And we do that jointly, we tend to do those together. So you actually have these mentalizing processes working in a flexible and adaptive to context manner. And they tend to balance each other in a way that's appropriate to circumstance. But of course, what you find is when they get out of balance, it's actually that imbalance that leads to symptoms. So you get experiences of certain aspects coming to the forefront of behaviors or personal experience. So in fact, we defined really four pairs of mentalizing areas that are important for clinicians to think about. And I'll just go through them quickly, but you can read about them a lot more. But for clinicians, it's really important. There's a self-other dimension. This is really important about how much you're focusing on self, how much you're focusing on your own belief systems or your own sense of your experience of yourself, how much you're focusing on others, and so on. And of course, sometimes we focus much more on others, sometimes much more on ourselves. But in general, constructive relationships actually have a balance between the two. And you can see that this could go quite wrong. So, for example, if we defer to others far too much, For example, so we sort of push to the back burner our own mental states, our own wishes, our own thoughts, our own desires, and actually simply defer to others. If we do that far too much, we become liable to exploitation, to abuse even, and people can actually control us and make us do things we may not really wish to do, and so on. So it can lead to real problems. Of course, we can go the other way, where we actually give priority to ourselves to such an extent we become described usually as sort of narcissistic or self-obsessed, or he only thinks about himself, or he uses other people just for his own ends and things like this. And that's where you start moving to the more narcissistic functioning of individuals and so on, because they get out of balance. We then have the sort of more, going back to the top of that slide, the more automatic sort of processing systems where we actually, they're great. You and I, we trot along with people walking along and we simply use an automatic mentalizing process of listening to them verbally, what they're saying, and actually picking up maybe what's behind it, what's going on with it, slightly beyond consciousness and so on. And we make assumptions about really what they're going, where they're moving to. And it works incredibly well. It's rapid, it's great, and it's really effective for human interaction. But there's a problem, because we can get it wrong. We start making automatic assumptions that are completely wrong. We start thinking our automatic assumptions are really right. So the whole thing can become distorted and so on. And if we make very quick assumptions about ourselves or others, we start becoming impulsive. We just do things without thinking them through. And really we need to combine that with a much more controlled mentalizing process, where we actually, as we call it in one of the programs here in the UK, you know, we've got to stop and think before we act. We have to actually begin to consider our things a little more carefully. We have to, it's a slower process, so it's not great for doing things in everyday life. But we, when there's a hiccup in an interaction, sort of think, why on earth did they say that? What on earth are they talking about? What do they mean? We tend to stop things. We say, hang on a minute, what made you say that? Where did that come from? Okay, and we move to this more controlled, reflective processing. But of course, if we do that too much, we slow everything up, and everything gets really boring. Everyone's saying, well, I'm not sure. Well, I think I might be saying it. It all gets rather too tedious. And that's why we call it sort of pseudo-mentalizing or even hyper-mentalizing, where people are just continually thinking about motives and explanatory phenomena about what someone's doing, why they're doing it, and so on and on and on. And it has very little grounding in reality when this occurs. So this is over-controlled mentalizing, really. So we switch to the other. And then, of course, we've got the cognitive processing system, as I said, and the affective processing system. And we know in borderline personality disorder that emotional processing system, identifying emotions, becoming dysregulated by emotions, being unable to actually grasp their sort of cognitive processing systems to manage their emotional states and so on, is actually a major problem for them. So they tend to be dominated by more affective processing. So these are the sort of, those are three of these dimensions, areas of mentalizing that we think are distinctly important in personality functioning. And then the final one is actually it's a little bit like an orange in a bunch of apples or something, but it's actually the focus of the mentalizing. Where is it? Is it very interior, self-focused, interior, other-focused, or something like that, internal sort of states about ideas or about current emotional states? Or is it much more exterior-focused? Is the information coming from the external focus, tone of voice, body posture, facial expression, the raising of an eyebrow that they notice very quickly, or something like that. And once you're so focused on the external, and you become hypervigilant, you become oversensitive, you're too quick to pick things up, and then you start making implicit automatic assumptions about what that means about the other person. you'll find that, you know, a patient might say to you, you look like that for, or something like that, and you have no idea how you looked, and you think, well, hang on a minute. And so in NBT, we're very interested in actually what they pick up, what's our mental state, what's their mental state. So we play around with this in the treatment quite a lot so that we can try and build greater accuracy in this system. So I was going to test you out really and say, well, where are people with borderline personality disorder here? Because you can map them into this model in terms of their mentalizing processes. And you can with antisocial personality disorder. And indeed, we translate this into our initial formulation with people with borderline personality disorder. So very briefly, they tend to be automatic assumptions. They tend to be overuse implicit automatic without moving enough to controlled mentalizing. They tend to be more affectively dominated, so they're affectively dominated. And they will tend to disregard themselves to some extent and actually become hypersensitive to others, their moods, and so on. So they have itself other problems, but they can vary across that dimension more. And they also tend to be hypervigilant. They're externally focused, generally speaking. So they're watchful and they're reactive. So this is how we begin to think about their sort of major symptom presentations from a mentalizing perspective. So what are you aiming for? You're aiming to get greater stability, more appropriate use of their mentalizing in the clinical situation and for them in their lives outside in general. So actually what good mentalizing looks like is actually a sense of mental states are a little unknowable, but you can know them to some degree. It works really well. You're not oversensitive. You actually are interested in mental states. You're reflective. You take perspectives. You accept difference and enjoy similarity to some degree, but actually enjoy difference too. And actually, you have a sort of sense of openness with yourself and others. And there's a predictability in the way that you interact with people. But poor mentalizing, of course, is much more difficult for general living. So people are anti-reflective, they're hostile, they tend to schematize, so they see people as abusers and I'm being abused and so on. It's a very rigid, fixed positions about their views of people and themselves especially, and that's a real problem. And they're unable to elaborate things or have flexibility in their thinking and so on. And you pick this up very quickly when people are in lower level mentalizing states. Now, we eventually, and I'm going to just have a break in a moment to see if there's any questions about this, rather gallop through the sort of clinical mentalizing. We do define three main modes of low-level mentalizing, which people complain about, which they rightly complain about, but it's sort of ineffective, and our patients tend to actually fall into them. Now, these are perfectly normal, by the way, and it's all very well for me to say, well, you know, they've got these three modes, you know, psychic equivalence, teleological mode, and pretend mode, but actually, we all do this. The question is how much and actually how often and how quickly we can get out of it. So these are perfectly everyday mental functioning processes that most of us don't drop into them too often, or when we do, we hop out quite quickly. So psychic equivalence is really once we get into fixed mind states where we know our mind state, this is how it is, this is what it is, and it's rigid, it's concrete thinking, and actually we believe our own story. This is what it is, and nobody can tell us any difference or anything. So we can be highly self-critical, we feel bad, we don't like ourselves, we know we're bad, and so on. And it's no good someone else saying, but I don't think you're bad. As far as they're concerned, in this state, you're just wrong. Okay? You can't persuade them different. So this is the sort of psychic equivalent fixed state. And when we're like that, we very often start to think about things in what has been called teleological function. We actually understand people's motives, their mental state, what their aims are, simply through what's done, what happens in the external world. Well, let me give you an everyday example. One of my students some time ago in a lecture, she put, said, can I ask a question? I said, of course you can. She said, well, look, I've been married now for 6 months, she said, and when my husband brings me flowers on a Friday night, I think it means he loves me. I mean, is that teleological? So here we have a question, which is actually the flowers and bringing them is an external, it's happening in the external world, it's out there, and it tells me, the wife, in this case my student, the actual state of mind of my husband's love for me. And of course this is hopefully quite correct, it's not a problem here. But actually, so I said to her, yeah, this is teleological, I said, and that's absolutely fine, but if I then ask you, do you rely on the flowers to tell you that your husband loves you? Likely, I wasn't going to let her answer, of course, I was likely to say, well, no, there are other things. I draw on a whole range of phenomena that gives me the experience my husband loves me. Problem is for us sometimes, and our patients, is that we rely totally on this. So if they don't bring the flowers, it means you don't love me. If you don't text me, that means you didn't want to talk to me, you didn't want to reply to me, you don't love me, and things like that. So they begin to rely on it, and that's where the problem starts. So teleological functioning is really important. And this is described in the literature for people with personality disorder who are very sensitive to when you're late or when you can't remember something and things like that and what it means to them. And then finally, we've got the third mode, which is pretend mode, which I've mentioned, where in general, it's the common form of this is hypermentalizing, where we actually understand motives, we talk about ourselves, we talk about others, but actually there's very limited grounding or reality in mental states, and it tends to be overly complex. So I put in a little slide the next one with the cartoon. This is typical hypermentalizing in adolescence, really. I texted Julie, I told her that just because I'm hanging out with Linda a lot, it doesn't mean I'm not her friend anymore. And she said she knows that, but she just feels weird because she thinks that Linda doesn't like her and because she thinks Linda and I have more in common. So I told her to stop worrying about what Linda thinks. And she said, fine, but I could tell she was upset. So I talked to Linda about it. And she said she does like Julie and so on. This sort of sense that is so common in schools, like adolescent, late adolescent. And my colleague, Carla Sharp, has written a lot about hypermentalizing and its importance in treatment for people with adolescent disorders and so on. So that's my gallop through sort of mentalizing. So basic definition, higher order cognitive integrative functioning, drawing things together, making sense of things, basically self and other, and then a range of dimensions, which once they get out of balance, actually tend to form into these ineffective mentalizing modes of psychic equivalence, teleological function, and pretend mode. So if I stop just for a moment, are there any questions out there that you just want me to try to answer briefly?
No questions have come through yet, Peter. I have a number of questions, but you are on a roll. Please do keep going.
Anthony, not...
Oh, sorry. That's a failure of mentalizing, isn't it? I apologize. I sincerely apologize. Please do keep going.
I won't get reactive. And
I appreciate it.
Okay, well, we'll pace on. But if anyone's out there and wants to interrupt, please try and indicate. So if they come in, send them to Emily quickly. Okay, so just some brief focus then just on attachment, simply because this is so important for us clinically and how we work this. I'm going to try and cover some of that in the summary in this talk. In a sense, as I mentioned, attachment and mentalizing are loosely coupled systems. So what is the key here in attachment? An attachment, basically, attachment process is a proximity-seeking behavioral process. So we actually proximity seek, and the biggest stimulus to that behavior is fear. So anxiety is actually the thing that triggers the attachment system. And when it's triggered, we actually, at that point, of course, proximity seek. And we proximity seek to someone who cares for us, who looks after us, or so on. And that soothes us. And we then feel safe again. Our anxiety goes down. And we continue our bond with that individual or those individuals. And they vary, of course, as life goes on. But actually, it reduces our anxiety, and then we can carry on. And indeed, holding hands and things in situations where someone's in an anxious situation, going for an operation or something like that, is actually something that soothes anxiety, because it's as long as it's holding the hand within an attachment process, an attachment relationship, is very soothing. So this is the sort of natural attachment process, and it leads to emotional regulation. It soothes our feelings. It soothes us. So it's not just a behavioral proximity system. It's actually a mental system that starts regulating affect. But we also know that, of course, if we've got problems in attachment processes of various types, that actually we don't get the same level of reduction in anxiety when we proximity seek. It actually doesn't necessarily work as well as we'd like. And then, of course, our anxiety levels continue. And when that happens, we actually continue an inhibition of mentalizing. Because as I said, as attachment goes up, mentalizing tends to go down. And so if our mentalizing goes down and remains down, we're not very good at judging things. We're not very good at appraising situations. We're not very good at knowing how we experience ourselves or what's happening in ourselves and so on. So we actually can't easily relate situations to behaviors, to context, and to integrate things. So we then tend to become much more reactive and behavioral. So we walk out, we leave, we run away, we demand, we actually challenge more than is necessary and so on. So, you know, we have situations, obviously, in the treatment of people with borderline personality disorder when they're desperate and they're frightened and actually they contact us and we feel, oh, you're contacting me far too much. I can't answer all these emails. But actually, or telephone calls, whatever. But actually, it is, of course, part of the natural reaction to the distress that they're experiencing, and that is continuing. It doesn't soothe, so they contact. So we have to build in ways of managing that, and treatments for people with borderline personality disorder have done. So we build in ways of trying to manage the attachment processes. So it's important to begin to understand that as a clinician, along with the mentalizing. So if we now translate all that to actually the clinical intervention, the easiest way to think about working with MBT and mentalization-based treatment is probably to think about it in domains, sort of areas of work. And I put a slide up which says domains of MBT. And you can see there's a sort of four processes which were inside a sort of tent, as it were, of the not knowing stance sessional structure which bridges round across. And that's the first thing, that the MBT is organized so that the whole process, the treatment process, is reasonably well structured across time, but there's also a sessional structure as well. So the clinician and the patient know what they're trying to generate within any single session, but also across time. So I'll come back to that. And within that, we actually ask the clinician across all sessions take what we call the not knowing stance. So we don't have an expert stance in a way. This is not to do with whether you know things, whether you have knowledge of borderline personality disorder, or whether you know what to do, what not to do. This is to do with not knowing mental states. Your job is to try to discover mental states or support the patient in actually identifying with increasing accuracy their own mental states and their understanding of others, including you, the clinician. So you use a particular stance in relation to that. It has to be authentic, and it has to be genuine to the questioning about just get me to where you are. What makes you say that? Take me there. No, I'm not quite following that. Is this sort of processing you're trying to get them to do? And we caution people not to take over the patient's mental states. And we tend to, as clinicians, because we so desperately want to help them very often, so we tend to take over. We start telling them what to do, or we start telling them what their mental state is. So we tell them how they feel. Oh, you're really feeling this. And things like that. Oh, what you really mean is this, and so on. And that's the sum we try to caution the clinician against. We also caution the clinician of integrating too much and then presenting it to the patient, because that doesn't stimulate the patient's mentalizing. It shows your excellent mentalizing, which we hope you have to a large extent, but it actually doesn't help them generate their own. So this is all embodied in the sort of not knowing stance position. And then within that, we have sort of a mentalizing process that you're trying to keep focused on to facilitate a whole sort of laboratory, really, of mentalizing process. You're also then working in non-mentalizing modes. This is ineffective mentalizing. When it's occurring, you're trying to actually shift it. You have to be alert to it to see it. It's not so difficult, really, to see it. But it's much harder to transform it. When you can transform it, of course, you actually try to then help them mentalize their narratives, that self-narrative that I began with. It's usually not well mentalized. It's usually a bit fixed. It's rather rigid. They tell you what they are, how they are, why they are, and all this sort of thing. And actually, you want to transform that to some degree, help them transform it into a mentalized narrative, all right? You want my sense of that is actually they need to be a bit more doubtful about things instead of so fixed, generally speaking. They say, well, yeah, I am somewhat like that, you know, but I don't have to be. I'm not always like that. I can be this, you know, rather than this is what I am, sort of thing. A little bit of safety in doubt is a great thing. And then the whole other domain, the final domain we work in, of course, is relation, what we call relational mentalizing. Can you actually mentalize whilst being in a more intense relational processing system? Now, this is not just with the clinician, like dynamic therapy in a sense. It's actually in relationships you're having outside with important figures in your life, if possible. And we do quite a lot of work on those processes. So that's the sort of summary. And we also, within that, suggest to clinicians that they can work in those domains really depending on the level of anxiety of the person with you. So if this person's in a state of high anxiety a lot of the time and that isn't reduced, you really have to spend your time working to generate a calmer mentalizing process. You can't do anything else. Actually, reduce arousal is one of the first principles in MBT if arousal is high. And then you're usually having to address non-mentalizing modes as well. And that's the work you will do in high-level arousal. Try to reduce the arousal to a large degree. And actually, when somebody's highly aroused, they're usually working in non-mentalizing modes. So you're simply trying to move around that. Once you've, as it were, managed that to some degree, reduced the anxiety, then you can start looking at the narratives much more carefully and even consider relationships and so on in a much safer environment. So anxiety and anxiety levels are actually the key to deciding on that, what to do. So we have a system, and this is part of the structure, where we have a careful assessment. We actually have an assessment that includes formulation, which is a mentalizing formulation, and that actually has certain components in it, which we actually discuss with the patients, and it's written down and written in a form that they can follow. It's in ordinary everyday language, and it has within it the focus that we're going to agree to start focusing on in treatment in various ways and so on. But it has to actually, when it's given to the patient, they need to think, yeah, this is me, this has got me in it. That's really what you're aiming for. You're not aiming for something clever. You're aiming for something that says, to the patient, yeah, this person gets me. And that's really important. And I've had great experiences with this over time, I can tell you. I have been had my formulations marked. That's great. That's wonderful. At least they read them, you know, because they're short. They're maybe a paragraph or two paragraphs at the most, if possible. That would be the longest. And I got 6 out of 10 on the last one that was marked. And I was very disappointed about this. 6 out of 10, I thought, oh dear, you know. There I am again in the middle of the class, you know, who got 8 or 9, you know. So I said, well, oh dear, where did I go wrong here? Well, I got a big cross against one thing. So I said, well, where did we go wrong here? And then you simply revisit it. And I got my mark up to 8 in the end after another session. So that was great. That was good enough to carry on. But really, you've got you and the patient thinking together, looking together about the patient's mental states and about their experiences. And that's the aim. We then actually bring them into an introductory phase where there's much more psychoeducation and we go through things to some extent. But we do use some process in those groups around the topic. And there's a list of topics which we've published, and you can try them out and so on. But they cover mentalizing, they cover emotions, and managing emotions and so on. And we give some emotional regulation skills in that sort of those sessions. And then we have sessions on attachments and so on. And they map their own attachment strategies and so on. Now, of course, this could be quite stimulating, and you have to be sensitive and manage these groups quite carefully because they're right at the beginning of treatment. And having done that, you then come into treatment. And the final one of that introductory sort of MBT phase is done in a group and is really difficulties they might think about might occur in treatment, and we discuss difficulties in treatment. And they're fantastic. They come up with great things always. You know, the sort of thing they come up and say, well, one of the problems I think I might have, what if I don't like my therapist? You say, well, that's actually a brilliant question. Actually, what do you do? What sort of therapist might you not like, or what would be a problem, and so on. So we generate a discussion around these things in this sort of aim of sort of at least mentalizing and getting some sense of actually what that may or may not mean and how it might be managed and so on. And they very often want to come into a group with the people they've just done the introductory group with. Say, can I come into a group with the people here? Well, actually, in our system, you can't necessarily, because we have a lot of groups running and we have a lot of introductory groups, so you tend to then get placed in the next group that has a vacancy and so on. So you tend to leave your safe haven at this group because you've managed to begin to trust each other a bit, and then you have to start again. So it's a bit of a trial for them. So we discuss all that, and then you come into the treatment itself. And the researched MBT was individual session once a week with a group session once a week. But very often now in MBT is delivered, although we don't know the evidence for this, in slightly dismantled ways in just group or just individual and so on. And people are doing trials on shorter term treatment, never a 20-week, 18-week, group treatment and so on, which people are looking at the ways of doing this and the effectiveness. So if we just move on then briefly, and then I will try and stop. See if any questions shortly. The not knowing stance I've mentioned, but this is very much a sort of position of the clinician who's a sort of more humble, interested and enthusiastic individual trying to help the person explore and to begin to integrate their experiences. Managing the process to make sure that we offer ways of them managing their arousal, managing their anxieties, and that includes empathic validation of their experience within the context of them talking with the clinician. And we defined empathic validation in certain ways. It's not simply reflective statements or say things that how the patient feels, but it is what we call affect and effect. So it's your current experience in this context and what effect that's having on you currently. currently and so on. And we try to actually push our clients in this process by using, I think, what a DBT clinician would call a sort of dialectic. But in our, for us, we actually use try to push them around what we call contrary moves, which is really around self or other, these dimensions of mentalizing. So if they're very automatic, get them to be controlled. If they're over-controlled, try to push for implicit mentalizing acceptance. If they're very affective, try to rebalance that with a more cognitive processing system. And we do that by either stimulating it in them, if we can, or actually us taking that particular position in relation to. So we become more cognitive as they're more affective, or things like that. This is an attempt to shift the balance of those dimensions. These are contrary moves. And we spend considerable time trying to address non-mentalizing modes, and where the patient is so fixed in their belief. So I know my boyfriend doesn't love me. What makes you say that? He didn't text me. If you loved someone, you would text them, wouldn't you? I told him, I said, you've got to text me. And he didn't. So I know he doesn't. So I texted him, told him to go away, you know, don't come home, or something like that. These are non-mentalized affective states, and then psychic equivalents. So we actually have to try to work to push those to a more affectively coherent and mentalized system. And we call this mentalizing the affective narrative. And we have ways of trying to focus that work. So I placed out some boxes, the affect trajectory, where you're simply trying to get them to increasingly mentalize, i.e. build context, reflect on the events to actually their experience now about themselves and the event and so on, their experience about talking about it, their self-experience now and so on. So it's a generation of a much more coherent and even complex representation of what's been happening rather than this rather collapsed single narrative, he doesn't love me or something of that nature, or she doesn't care about me and so on. But whilst we're doing this, we ask the clinicians also to be monitoring much more implicit processes. And this is what we call the elephants in the room. Are there elephants in the room that might be interfering with the process of therapy at this time? And if so, they need to be more explicitly elaborated. So they're implicit very often, and they need to become more explicit. So this is rather like, let me give you a client I have at the moment. She has two children, and they're under child protection at the moment. And our sessions gradually became infused, I think, with a sort of sense of her worry about whether I was thinking she's a decent mother, a good mother or not, or something like that. This was never, she never asked this, and so on, but she was would ask questions like, do you think I'm doing okay, and so on. You know, do you think I'm improving, and so on. So she was looking to me, rather than looking to herself about whether was she doing okay, was she improving, was she getting anything out of treatment. But part of that was an elephant, and the elephant was, am I going to say that she's a good mum, and therefore she might get her children back? And these implicit processes interfere with the treatment overall. And we call these the elephants in the room. And it's important you try to identify these, because they do tend to actually direct relational processes between people. And if they're not elaborated and understood, they tend to actually distort the relationships that people are having. And that's where we move into more relational mentalizing of the experience that the person has in their lives outside, in the relationships, with their experience in the clinic of coming here, or whether actually their experience they're having with us or within the treatment and its usefulness and so on, or then how they understanding themselves in relation to us. Do we make them feel good about themselves, worse about themselves, anything? And we explore those within the relationship quite openly. So a very quick example, a patient of mine says, tells me, she said, oh, I saw you on YouTube. She says, you weren't very good, you know. No, sort of way. So she told me that I hadn't stood up for myself properly. I said, well, what might I have done? She described that I was being, she thought, ill-treated by someone else at this meeting that I was talking at. and who was very critical of me, and I should have reacted and I should have defended myself. And in a way, she's probably quite right. This is a perfectly reasonable experience and so on. But the question was, did that matter or not to her or so on? Well, she didn't like it at all. She was actually rather cross about this. The idea, she was seeing a clinician who didn't stand up for himself, and she'd always thought I at least was one person who would and so on. We gradually elaborated this, and actually it turned out that her whole sense was that actually she was actually watching something that simply undermined her own sense in the end of whether or not she had achieved anything, because her view was that if I'd never stood up for what I'd achieved, what the hell had she done? Because she didn't think she'd ever achieved anything as much as I had. So she had a whole comparator system going on implicitly in the relationship, to which she was quite sensitive to, and actually undermined her own self-value, really, to a large extent. It turned out she was constantly doing this. She was seeing other people as having greater achievements and so on. And actually, in the end, rather than, say, triggering a sort of energy to achieve and to generate more herself, it undermined her. And she felt that she'd never really done anything. So it had quite a negative effect on her. And within that, in MBT, we do actually spend quite some time considering the clinician's mental states. We do self-disclosure in the sense of our mental states in relation to, particularly if there's problems in treatment itself. And this is what we call the counter-relational responsiveness and mentalizing that. And a quick example would be we're doing a large randomized trial at the moment with people with antisocial personality disorder, and they're to be included in the study, they have to have recent histories of violence towards others, because the primary outcome is a reduction in violent episodes and so on. And of course, that means they're quite a risky population. So when you're sitting with somebody in an individual session, you could be sort of unnerved, or they could be somewhat coercive, or even make you rather anxious about safety. Now, obviously, you have to take that risk in how you organize everything, but actually being intimidated creates a mental state in you, which actually in the end is probably something that they're doing anyway wherever they are. So actually we look at this, and one way we look at this is actually present to the individuals our mental state in relation to. So you have to find ways of saying, well, look, I want to talk here about something a little important. I don't want you to take this sort of badly or to say you're doing something wrong. But the way you are at the moment with me actually fixes me. I get a bit nervous about this. I'm just not sure it's safe. And when I'm like that, I find it very difficult to focus on what you're talking about. So in other words, you try to pick up the mental state you're having in relation to the mental states that they're having. And then you work on those together to try to see if they can actually give some sort of interest in others' mental experience. In that situation, by the way, that person with antisocial personality disorder often says something like, that's your problem, mate. So, of course, in MBT, you say, no, absolutely, it is my problem, and I'm sort of sharing it to see if we can work out if we can actually reduce my problem, because then I can actually work more carefully with your problem, which is my job. So we do present our own mental states for them to work on. So this is the general process. It's all placed through back into the original formulation, which then changes over time, of course, because you begin to understand things differently and so on. And this sort of MBT, which focuses on the mentalizing, the attachment processes, relational mentalizing, and the vulnerability to loss of mentalizing, has now been adapted, as I say, from borderline personality disorder to antisocial personality disorder, narcissistic personality disorder, eating disorders, families and carers with significant others with BPD. We do a family carers program for them, so just for the families, self-harming adolescents, substance abuse disorders, families and children with the families that have got problems, really, and mothers and babies, of course. And there's considerable research around the globe on all these areas and mentalizing. So I will draw to a close there and hope that I haven't spoken too fast and
so much, Anthony. What an engaging and erudite gallop through mentalization-based therapy. I particularly enjoyed the way you peppered each of the points you were making with stories to illustrate key concepts or therapeutic strategies. I found myself struck, as you described things, about the parallels and also the distinct differences between mentalization-based therapy and dialectical behavior therapy. So one question for you. You mentioned that one of the things that MBT works hard to avoid doing is to package things too much for a person, to tell them how they're feeling or formulate it too neatly for them, because otherwise, well, for one reason, it stops them from having to learn how to do this for themselves. And you also noted that communication of empathy and validation is also important. So can you highlight the types of things that might be done in MBT that avoid falling into that trap of both communicate understanding but avoid falling into the trap of telling the person
what they feel? No, it's a great question because you're absolutely right that we're trying not to take over knowing their mental states. And, of course, that's really difficult to do in many ways, and because you're trying to get them to generate. And the reason we worry about that is because we worry about imposing our own values, our own views, our own sort of constructs onto them,
right,
which might generate pretend mode in them. It might generate this sort of, oh, now I understand it. Yes, so that's what it is. So you start living something that's really someone else's. And what you want them to do is really take what you're doing and then generate their own use, if you see what I mean, and develop themselves in that way. But you're absolutely right. That's a bit of a problem, because if you then generate, what I said, let's say, some empathic validation, you are technically, of course, to a large extent, at that point, integrating your sense of their internal state. And that delivers it to them in a way, because that's what empathic validation does. So really, that's fine and that's great. We do a lot of that. But you have to do the work first. And one of the problems is that clinicians do it far too early.
Mm-hmm.
They do sort of 2 or 3 minutes interaction or something, and then they make this sort of validation statement of quite a strong level, high level.
Right.
And actually you say, well, hang on a minute. You've got to do the work first to be clear, and you and the patient just become increasingly clear about what that current state is.
Mm-hmm.
But it takes a bit of work. I mean, I think, to be honest, to do a full empathic validation takes, you know, about something, around something of the patient's current state, let's say, takes 10 minutes work or more.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not talking here about just reflecting back, saying, aha, or when they say difficult, you just say, oh, difficult, or, and you know, do you see what I mean? I'm actually talking about more integrating it into a context in some way about their experience overall, without judgment. The patient tells a story, for example, well, I'll give you a recent one, you know, of how she managed in a very difficult situation, but she managed herself, she controlled herself, whereas the time before she'd actually created such a disturbance she had to be removed from the context by the ushers in the place she was in, and the whole proceedings had been brought to a close, they'd have to be abandoned because she had attacked someone because she was emotionally overwrought. The second sort of hearing that she was in, we did some work on this and she managed it. So she's telling me actually about this, but actually, as she told me about her managing, you think, well, this is really positive, isn't it? You know, this is great, she managed it, and so on. But actually, that wasn't her current state. Her current state was to do, as you elaborated this, it turned out she thought it would make no difference whatsoever that she managed all that, but people would still see her as this sort of crazy person who was just blows up and it can't be trusted and so on. That's how this is. So it's a waste of time. There was no point in doing it. Do you see what I mean? So it's quite a complex state. So I was then able to say, okay, so actually, here's the affect here. You actually feel quite pleased with yourself. I think this is absolutely right. It's coming across really strongly. You thought you're proud of it, actually. This is a, and so on. So you get a hold of that, but we then want the effect in it. And the overall, it doesn't lead her to feel, right, now I'm in the next step or something like that. It actually has this effect on her as she thinks, but actually it's a waste of time. There's no point. It's very disappointing. You see what I'm getting at? And that's the effect. So then we're dealing with actually, if she improves, she believes it won't make any difference anyway.
Right.
So this is a bit shitty.
So it's a
So that's a much wider empathic validation of the current state.
Absolutely. And if someone were to just jump in first with what they were assuming were the case, that the rest of that conversation may not have occurred.
Yes, exactly. So it's never elaborated to a much higher level of complexity.
Yes, okay.
It tends to get closed off, actually. That's the problem.
Yes, I can imagine. I'm thinking about my own statements as we talk, as I speak to you now, thinking perhaps I need to be understanding more about what you're describing before before communicating that I get it and I agree. Okay, two more questions for you. One is, what advice do you have for family members and loved ones of someone with borderline personality disorder from the mentalization perspective?
Oh, well, yeah, what we did with that, we published a trial on that, a randomized controlled trial, actually, but basically what we recommended was, I mean, of course they have to have knowledge about it in some way, that many of them have. Interestingly, in America, they tend to be more knowledgeable than the UK, but so knowledge is really important, and some sort of compassionate understanding of the problem. So we certainly do that with the family. But we also think that one of the mentalizing skills they've got to have is, one is managing themselves. They need mentalizing themselves to manage their emotional states is really important, because they can get so upset, so frustrated, so angry even, and things like that, naturally so, that they tend to give up even or things. So it's really important they can actually keep their own mental states in some sort of order. So that's one thing. But actually, the other thing that we use and sort of train them in these family sessions, we just do 5 evening sessions, was to see things from the point of view of their loved one, of their family member, of their significant other. And their job really is to try to ask questions, to try to see it from the other person's perspective. Mm. So what are they experiencing? So mentalizing other is one thing we do role plays in. We get them to actually, one of them is, you know, their significant other in a difficult situation, and the one of the other family members then tries to do a sort of mentalizing other process, and we all observe that, and we all practice, and we all do it, and so on. And that they find really helpful to and so that, I think, from a mentalizing perspective, is really important.
Yes. This has been so helpful. Thank you very much, Anthony. So one more question before you go, and this is the voice of self-interest speaking. What are you using to measure violent behavior with your randomized controlled trial?
With that trial, the primary outcome measure is a modified version of the overt aggression scale. So we're using that. The protocol of all that is all published. You'll find it on the Randomized Controlled Trials website. You know, it's all pre-published methodology and outcome, primary outcomes and secondary outcomes.
Marvelous. Thank you.